Welcome to the Write for a Living podcast, where I talk to writers of all kinds, and today I'm talking to Jordan Thomas, who is a comic book writer who's written such books as Man from Maybe and Weird Work. So welcome to the show.
Hey, Carly. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start with a few icebreakers, because I think those are fun. So what is your favorite book that you've read so far, or maybe just the last book that you've read?
Last night, I actually read for the first time Mouse, if you know that, like, really famous Art Spiegelman, quite kind of harrowing Holocaust memoir of his father, where all the Jewish people are mice and the Nazis are all cats. So yeah, I actually spent, I think it took me about 4 hours from 10 p.m. to 2 in the morning last night reading that for the first time.
I haven't read that, but I saw that it was trying to be banned. So I always had that on my radar. Like, I should read that because people are trying to ban it in schools.
Yeah, I think that they're actually, the reason that they want to ban it is because there's a few little bits of mice nudity in it, where they've got like little mice nipples and things, which apparently bothers people more than like the harrowing kind of murder of all the Jewish people in the story. But yeah, no, it's an amazing book, which I would advise anyone to check out.
Yeah, that's weird. Okay, so number two was just a normal one. Like, what is your favorite food?
My favorite food, probably pizza.
Yeah. And then the third one was, if you could be any Star Wars character, which one do you think you would be?
Which one do I think I would be, or which one would I want to be?
Okay, that somebody asked me that question again yesterday. I guess which one? Let's do both. Which one do you think you'd be, and which one do you want to be, if they're different?
I'd probably end up being like maybe like one of the rebels, but who kind of tends to sit behind a computer as opposed to necessarily piloting like a ship into the Death Star. But I'd probably want to be a Jedi.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. That's realistic. yeah. So let's just start at the beginning. What did you do before comics? And like, did you love them as a kid? And like, kind of how did that whole thing start? What did you do before, and how did you actually get into this? If you can tell that backstory.
So as a kid, my dad was really bad at putting any kind of limits on anything that I watched or read. So from a really young age, I was really into like Arnold Schwarzenegger action films and gangster films and things like that. And I really got into the trading card collecting. So you could get like the Marvel Fleer set 95 or whatever, and it had all the different characters. So that was kind of my introduction, I guess, that and the X-Men animated series, the Batman animated series. So I really loved story, and I really like loved and knew a lot about superheroes. But it probably wasn't until around 11 or 12 years old that I started actually reading comics that my friends started to lend to me. And from there, I actually studied script writing for film and television at university. So I always wanted to do something around telling stories. And so I kind of worked in corporate copywriting, the exciting world of mobile learning for a while, which was like training people with short animated videos on mobile phones. So I'd have to read like all the business books and write scripts for the short animations about giving a great presentation or having difficult conversations. I did that in London for close to 5 years, and then decided I'd had enough of working in an office and having someone tell me that I needed to kind of sit at a desk from 9 till 5 every day, regardless of whether I had any work to do or not. So I actually moved to Spain from England and did a bit of English teaching over there and some freelance copywriting, which freed up my time enough that I got into making my own comics. I had a few friends who were using Kickstarter to make their own comics. So I got involved with them, helping them at first, like edit their comics, and then making my own and using Kickstarter to get those out there. Yeah, from there, they were kind of, I guess, good enough and popular enough. I started to get some opportunities with publishers. And then around 14 months ago, I kind of went full time as a comic writer and left the corporate copywriting behind.
I have a few questions from that. One is, I've watched some of your other interviews, and I wanted to actually ask about Spain, because it doesn't seem like you dived into that a bit. And I wanted to ask, why did you move to Spain? And, like, how do you like it? Because are you in the UK? Me and my friend were watching your interviews, and I think you're from the UK, right?
Yep.
You said? Okay. Because we were having a debate, and then we had to look it up, because he was like, no, he sounds Australian.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard that a couple of times. I don't know if there's something where living in Spain for quite a while is somehow like polluted my accent, and somehow combining like Spanish accent with English accent, you get Australian or something.
Yeah, I don't know. But how do you like Spain, and why did you actually choose to move there?
So I love Spain. Spain's an amazing place to live. I ended up moving there because I lived with a bunch of friends in London in like a big shared house. And one of my friends there actually went to Spain to teach English. And I visited him a couple of times, and I saw that he was paying like 100 euros a month rent, and it was a euro for a beer. And in London, it was like £600 a month for a room in a 5-room house and everything, you know, like the ticket for the metro transport for the month was like 140 quid. So you kind of don't really have time to pursue the things you really want to pursue whilst doing that. So you need to be working a pretty well-paying job just to get by in London. So although I'd done scriptwriting, film and TV at Bournemouth University, I hadn't really been pursuing doing my own writing as much as I wanted to. So I just decided, you know, I'd visited my friend a couple of times and he was living over in Spain. So I just quit my job and moved over to stay with him for a while. And straight away, I actually got a job working as a conversation partner at the English Academy that he worked at. And that kind of paid a little bit of money to cover rent and stuff. And yeah, from there, I just kind of fell in love with it. Like the first place in Spain that I lived is called La Línea de la Concepción. It's in Cádiz in the south. And if you are to tell a Spanish person that you live there, they'll be like, hey, it's terrible. Why would you live there? Like, it's considered like one of the worst parts of Spain. It's a bit like nowhere in Spain is that bad, but it's a bit like as close to the Spain's version of The Wire. If you've seen that HBO TV series, like that's where they kind of traffic all the drugs in from Africa, like over the sea there. And we were living in this big kind of tower block that looked like one of the projects out of The Wire. And it was all a little bit kind of crazy, and there'd be helicopters every night, like trying to catch the people trafficking drugs kind of over. So it's not the most picturesque part of Spain. But from there, I lived in Sevilla for a bit, in Seville, and then to Granada, where I stayed for a long time, which is an absolutely beautiful city. So yeah, I just kind of fell in love with the place, really. And Spain also has a really great culture for comics, like. I mean, just the talent that are working in America at the moment. You've got Pepe Larraz, Jorge Fornes, Iván Coelho, Bruno Redondo. So many like amazingly talented people, and a lot that I've got to become friends with kind of over the years of living in Spain. So the convention culture is really fun there. Like everything with Spain, it's always based around food. So whereas a convention in like America or England, you know, you're there for like 8 hours behind the table. In New York, you're there for like 12 hours or something behind the table, and at the end of the day you maybe grab a quick burger or something, whereas all the Spanish conventions are very much like, okay, it's lunchtime, we close for 2 hours, we're all going off for a massive lunch, and everyone comes back a little bit drunk, and then you kind of do it again in the evening as well. So I wouldn't move back. I'm in Valencia now, which is another really cool city, which was actually the home of comics in Spain for the kind of 50s and 60s. And yeah, it's a really great country to live being a comic book writer.
I'm going to have to do some research because the history of that sounds really interesting.
It's amazing. I think my best friend in Valencia is Kian Tormey, who is the current artist on the Green Lantern Golden Age book. So he's Irish, but yeah, so me, the English guy and the Irish guy, hanging out in Spain. But we've actually started, we've made friends with a group of kind of comic enthusiasts and creators who live in Valencia. But there's this whole pool of like 70, 80 year old guys who all were like working for 2000 AD and lots of the French publishers like back in the 80s and 90s. And we kind of just go and meet for an hour and have like a beer or a coffee. And all these guys who worked on like Vampirella and Judge Dredd and things, but they're just like these, you know, these nice, sweet old men who, unless you ask them, you'd have no idea that they were like successful comic artists. But yeah, there's a lot of history there.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, that just sounds really awesome. So one of the things that I did want to touch on, which I found interesting, and maybe you might too, just because I read your comic. One I read, and then I dove into all this, and I had to order more, and I was like so excited about it. But I seen that you were also into into crime, and then you just mentioned The Wire. And I was talking with my friend, and my friend mentioned that the most interesting part about The Wire was the fact that they had this like intricate communication system, like for like drug running and stuff, where they were like using the phones and like kind of like code. And yeah. I thought that was really interesting and cool. And yeah, I don't know. Just wanted to mention that because that might be something in the future to like think about. But I got into cryptography a while back and like story writing, and I just noticed how much kind of there's some symbolism with that. And then, you know, The Wire was talking about it. So I kind of went off on a little ramble there, but I wanted to mention that in case you found that interesting as well with The Wire. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I just got finished watching the Narco series on Netflix. I watched the original one, which deals with Colombia, a while ago, but I just watched Narcos Mexico, and there's quite a lot of that in there as well, where they're trying to bring people in to listen to recorded tapes to try and figure out if what are they talking about, you know, what the different slang terms and codes mean for where they're going to be delivering product or moving it across country. And yeah, I think that's a pretty classic kind of move from going way back hundreds of years.
Yeah. I think that stuff's like incredibly interesting. So I wanted to get back on to like how when you were getting into comics, you mentioned the copywriting and the Kickstarter. And with copywriting, I wanted to ask, I read Eugene Schwartz's book, and like in the beginning of his copywriting book, he mentions that there's like collective energy, and if you can tap into this collective energy of people, whether it's like their hopes, their dreams or fears or whatever, then usually you'll be successful with whatever, if you're, I guess, writing something in copywriting. And do you think that the copywriting background that you have has helped you in comics at all? And did you ever use that in your comics, like talking about like bigger issues in terms of like maybe fears, hopes, dreams of people as a collective?
I definitely think working in the copywriting has helped in terms of giving me like a good business background, because as well as doing the writing's kind of the nice part, the fun part that you enjoy doing, but there's so much more to getting a successful career in comics than actually being good at writing comics. You could argue on quite a lot of stuff it's one of the lesser important things in terms of having to like deal with editors and get projects picked up, like it, and then managing projects, especially when I was doing the Kickstarter books. Like, you've probably seen, like, there can be quite a toxic atmosphere if a project gets very delayed, and you know, you promise to deliver it in December 2018 and then it's 2020 and you still haven't delivered it. So I think a lot of those kind of management skills from working in the corporate world have actually kind of helped me a lot with being quite professional and knowing how to manage a team, because often, you know, I'm the writer, but especially on the Kickstarter books, I'm managing the artists, the letterer, I'm editing myself, I'm dealing with designers and printing companies and then distribution. So from that side, I definitely think that that's useful. I guess maybe when you're kind of working on the pitches to send over to editors, trying to be able to tap into what's going to make them excited about your story, because you can often describe in a one-word document the same story in kind of multiple different ways where you choose what to focus on. And I mean, it's a bit of a tricky game, really. There's the famous story of Robert Kirkman pitching The Walking Dead to Image, where he told them that it was going to be revealed in the sixth issue that it was all aliens who had created the zombies, because at the time Image weren't really interested in taking just a pure zombie book as a series. And after, I don't know, I think when it got to around that issue, one of the guys at Image said, that's cool, Robert, but when did the aliens arrive? And he's like, oh no, I made all that up so that you'd commission the book. And there's not that I'd ever lie to any of my editors out there, especially any that are listening to this right now. Yeah, you do have to kind of understand what's popular in the moment and like you say, kind of plug into what part of your story is going to grab their attention. I really love historical stuff, but it's quite hard to get historical pitches picked up because for whatever reason, the vibe out there with publishers at the moment is that it's a lot harder to sell something that's maybe set in the 16th century and deals with, say, political happenings during whatever empire you want to choose, kind of, that was around at that time. So people like, when I show them my comics, they're always like, oh, I really like sci-fi stuff. And it's like, I do really like science fiction. But that's the reason that a lot of my books are science fiction, is because those are the pitches that publishers tend to like. If you're like, this is noir combined with sci-fi, or this is a Western combined with science fiction, then that seems to be what they think will sell at the moment. So trying to kind of get some of those maybe closer to your heart pitches through that you know are going to be tough, but trying to find that hidden kind of theme maybe that's in there but that isn't immediately obvious is quite an important part of working in comics, I think.
And so you went from Kickstarter and now working with publishers, but like, would you ever go back to Kickstarter to do some of the things that you just mentioned, like if you really wanted to and it wasn't getting picked up?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess a good example for when I'd go back to Kickstarter would be if I wanted to do like a really nice collection of something that I'd released with a publisher, like Weird Work, the book that I had out with Shaky Kane the past year from Image. Let's say we did a few more Weird Work stories. It depends how my career goes, but I'm kind of realistic that right now, one of those beautiful kind of big deluxe hardcovers that Rick Remender's always releasing, probably Image isn't going to let us do one of those because financially it's a big risk if you don't know how many you're going to sell, because they cost a lot to produce. But the good thing with Image is that you've got all the control over your own work. So say me and Shaky released another 100 or so page Weird Work story, then probably I'd go back to Kickstarter to take Weird Work number one, Weird Work number two, and the couple of little short stories we've done in the universe and combine it together into a really beautiful deluxe oversized hardcover. At the moment, I'm not really looking to do any new stories through Kickstarter just because I'm kind of at that point where I'm trying to build up my name in the direct market and get more opportunities there. And it is a lot of work, like especially if you're doing a series like I was doing on Kickstarter, where you've maybe got 3 or 4 issues to get out there, it's like every issue you've got to do the marketing campaign, you've got to do whilst the campaign's actually running and making sure you actually get enough backers and make enough money to produce the book. But then you also have to handle all the logistics of printing. And like, as we were talking about earlier, I live in Spain, but I did all that from the UK. So I'd have to travel back to my mum's in the UK, where I had spent then 2-3 weeks staying up till 1-2 in the morning, sitting at the kitchen table, packaging everything into envelopes, and trips down to the post office with like 4 tons of comics kind of over my shoulder. So yeah, right now I don't really have the time for all the stuff either side of the Kickstarter projects. Like actually making the book isn't the problem. It's kind of everything else that goes into it that luckily the publishers handle when you're working in the direct market. But yeah, definitely it's something probably in 2025 or 2026 I'll look at going back to.
And do you choose the titles? Because I'm like, Man from Maybe, Weird Work, Frank on the Farm, you know, they all have like the same letter. I was wondering, do you make the titles? Because it's kind of like they all had similar things.
So Weird Work and Frank at Home on the Farm were both mine. The Man from Maybe was actually Shaky Kane's title. That was his, Shaky's great with a title. He's always messaging me and being like, what about this? And it's just a title. And then that's kind of it. But he'll be like, what do you think? Like, The Man from Maybe. That sounds great, right? And you're like, yeah, no, it sounds good, Shaky. What's it about? So I don't know. You come up with that part. But yeah, so. Two of mine, one was Shaky's.
Yeah, the title is important, though. I feel like if you have a good title, it kind of grabs people's attention and makes them want to read it.
Oh, definitely. A lot of time can be lost to trying to come up with good titles for comics.
My next question was, how does the process go? Because you talked a little bit about it, but so do you... Like you had just mentioned, you know, he might send a title and then you come up with a story or something. But like, how do you do it now? What is the process? Do you just like have an idea that you develop further? Or like, what is the process of actually going through and making a comic with a team? And like, how do you choose a team and stuff like that?
I guess it varies depending on the project. So when I work with Shaky, I always know that Shaky's going to be doing the art first. And Shaky has a very kind of Americana, Jack Kirby inspired, but through a slightly kind of creepy lens, like a little bit like a slightly more deranged Michael Red kind of look. And there's certain things that Shaky's really good at, and then things that would probably be a bit of a waste, like making Shaky do a whole kind of dramatic people sitting in rooms talking comic wouldn't really be taking advantage of his skill set for designing really bizarre characters and filling the world of the story with all kinds of strange background monsters and things like that. So with Shaky, Weird Work, I came up with the whole story, but knowing it was going to be for Shaky. The Man from Maybe, Shaky had the title and the design for the lead character, and also gave me the opening. So it opens with something crashing from space in a kind of prehistoric looking setting. And then a NASA space buggy drives out of some trees and a couple of astronauts get out to inspect it. And they find like there's some kind of dead dinosaur skeletons on board. And then they take off their helmets and they're dinosaurs as well. So that was Shaky's pitch. He was like, okay, thing crashes into some dinosaurs, NASA space buggy. But wait, the astronauts are also dinosaurs. So I had that as kind of the beginning and knew that I was going to combine it with the Western character that he had. And then I came up with kind of the rest of the story from there. A new project that I'm doing with my friend Chris Matthews, who we did one of the Mugshots crime book together. That was where he told me kind of what genre he wanted to work in. And he did a couple of concepts in terms of how he wanted it to look. And then I made up the story from there. So that's quite fun because it gives both people a real feeling of ownership over the project when you've both been involved in coming up with it, as opposed to me coming up with the story and then the artist having to draw it. And I think then they always feel a little bit more like an employee than like a partnership, if that makes sense. But I mean, I've done it the other way as well. I've got a project that hasn't been announced yet, but that I'm working on for a publisher. And we don't have the artist yet, but I've written the first four scripts. So that one's kind of all me. But then still probably when we find the artist, I'll go back and slightly tweak stuff because Clark Bint, who I worked on Frank at Home on the Farm with, he's an artist that does small detail really well. So his pages will often have lots of little small panels, like showing little actions. And he loves to do, if he does a big splash, everything will be filled with small details, whereas Shaky's much more big and bold. And he's better with fewer panels on the page. So I'd write very differently for Clark than I would for Shaky, for example. So it kind of depends on the project.
And then do you have advice for anybody that's listening to this who might be a writer now that wants to get into comic book writing? Where do you think they should start? And yeah, just any advice or maybe like what not to do.
I think what not to do is to go on to the Facebook groups where people are looking to find collaborators and saying things like, hey, I've got this idea for a 2,000-page graphic novel, and I think it could be a great film franchise, and maybe they'll make a theme park out of it. Who wants to draw that for free for me? Which you see quite a bit. Understanding, I guess, there's nothing wrong with finding an artist collaborator and you guys working together and not paying that a bit being a proper partnership, but bringing your own story and then trying to get artists to draw it for free because it is going to make millions when it becomes the next Marvel Universe or something, even though you haven't actually made any other comics before, is probably a bad way to go. I'd say like start small, like maybe try to write some scripts for some anthologies, like on Kickstarter, there's always quite a lot of people doing anthologies, whether it'll be like, I've seen ones that are like a sci-fi noir anthology or maybe like a cyberpunk anthology and submit to those. Be a big reader, like kind of read everything, like comics and books and watch all the best TV shows and try and pick apart why they worked, why you like them, why they're popular, and learn about story structure. I'd say the two William Goldman scriptwriting books are both really good. He was the screenwriter behind Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, The Princess Bride. His books are both really great for just learning about kind of how to hook an audience and how to find the story, like the interesting part of the plot within your story. So, yeah, I think like just doing it, like we have a lot of options now with Kickstarter and Patreons and the internet in general. Like it's allowed you to be able to get together with a friend and make a 4-page comic and put it out there and see what people think and then make another one and another one. Because in reality, they're going to, when I speak to people who are kind of talking about like, oh, how do I pitch to this publisher or that publisher? And how did you get a book with Image? Like, I'd love to get a book with Image, but they haven't actually made anything yet. Publishers aren't going to pick up your pitches when you don't have a track record of being able to actually make comics. So I would say, yeah, definitely get out there and make some shorter comics to start with and kind of build from there.
That's great advice. I was looking at your, I think this is your website.
Maybe.
The Burnt.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yep.
Okay.
Is that the Big Cartel thinking, one? I've got a newsletter. Like, and I've got, well, I'm not very good at maintaining these things. So
okay.
I think I launched the Big Cartel Burnt Barn one just as Elon Musk's kind of sunk Twitter. And it became very hard to market anything. So I haven't really been doing very much of it. But yeah, I've got that and I've got the Substack Burnt Barn business newsletter.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was just looking, because you had said, like, just start and, like, create. So I was going to mention the Burnt Barn. But I wasn't actually sure because it was attached to one of the Kickstarters, I think.
So Burnt Barn Comics is, like, the kind of little publisher I made up for myself for everything I do through Kickstarter. But yeah, there's the Big Cartel site, Burnt Barn Comics, Big Cartel, where you can get some of the Kickstarter comics I made.
Okay, awesome. Because I just wanted to mention that because it might be interesting if people wanted to look at that. I'll add it in the description of everywhere this is posted. As an example, and just like to check it out. So we kind of covered some of my questions. Why I wanted to get into the storytelling part too before this ends, because I think that's like one of the most important parts. So when you were talking about the script writing, one of my favorite, I think, like script writers that I've come across so far is, I think his name is Paul Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm getting that name right. And I think he took, I forget the author's name of the book, but turned it into There Will Be Blood, the movie.
Oh, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes, thank you. Yep. And he did this movie called Master. And from there, once I watched that and I got into all these other like crime ones, I wanted to ask you about that. And then I followed that back. So the storytelling is so important. Like, with his storytelling as well, it seems like he kind of had these underlying stories to it, where it's like these people were so conflicted emotionally, and there's all these power struggles. I'm getting off track here with my question, but like, how do you put that into comics, and like, how important do you think storytelling is as a whole? You know, because before you said that, well, you had to be a good writer, but you know, writing isn't like the main thing of like getting to be successful. But I think storytelling really is important. So, can you kind of talk a little bit about that? I know that was like totally off everywhere, but yeah.
Sure. Well, storytelling is definitely the most important part of making good comics. I think what I said before was more of a comment on, I guess, like the business side, that you kind of have to be able to do a few different things beyond just writing well to get into comics, as you do in kind of most industries. You know, you might get lucky meeting someone who can help you out, or, you know, maybe you're part of a comics making family and you get your foot in the door that way. But I mean, I guess what you're talking about, Paul Thomas Anderson, is the difference between plot and theme. So in There Will Be Blood, which is probably one of my favorite films, the plot is about a man who mines for oil and becomes very financially successful whilst betraying a lot of people and, you know, making a lot of enemies. That's kind of the surface level. But then you've also got the inner turmoil that he is dealing with as someone who obviously finds trusting anyone else almost impossible. He adopts this son, but really he's adopted the son to make him more appealing to his business partners, to look like a family man, when in reality it's debatable as to whether he's able to care about anyone but himself. So I guess that's the kind of themes going on underneath, and the idea of capitalism and just striving for more and more and more, even when you have more than enough, and your willingness to kind of do anything to get it, to succeed, I guess. So I think that you kind of need both. I mean, you will get things where maybe theme is the driving force as opposed to a plot. Like maybe if you watch like a Jim Jarmusch film or something like that, there won't be a whole lot of story in there, but there'll be an awful lot of character. But yeah, I think things work best when you can combine both. Like, I guess Watchmen's a great example. Watchmen has an awful lot of plot, but there's an incredible amount of theme going on underneath about people's fears and how they kind of drive us to behave in different ways. And then obviously the kind of the fear of the nuclear option that was looking likely in the 80s at one point. So I think it can be, often you'll come up with a story idea that's more focused on, or my in personal experience, this is how I find it. You'll have the plot and then you'll kind of find the themes underneath it. Like Frank at Home on the Farm, the first series that I had published, which was published by Scout Comics. That is a story about a guy who comes home from World War I to his family's farm, thinking they're going to be waiting for him with open arms, but his family have disappeared. And over the course of the story, he's having nightmares about being back on the front line and all these animal soldiers appearing. And then the animals on the farm, who are the only thing that are left, start to kind of speak to him, and the story kind of goes from there. But a lot of the plot is about being, a lot of the theme underneath the plot is about being isolated and how that can make you feel towards the outside world. He becomes very distrusting of the outside world, and that just leads to his kind of own destruction ultimately. And I get, you could take, for example, something that happened in England a few years ago where we voted for Brexit, which is very much a kind of, you know, trying to shut the door on the rest of the world and being very insular and not looking to others. And that's something that I don't agree with. And I think that that's been negative for England in the same way that Frank kind of locking himself up on the farm and just in the same way that I guess on social media, people, you can get caught in a vacuum of your own opinion, and how a lot of these people who are very negative in the way they think about things, they just search out more views that kind of reinforce that opinion, as opposed to kind of looking for the wider world. And ultimately, I think for the soul, that's very negative. And so a lot of Frank at Home on the Farm was about that, where he didn't want to deal with the reality of the world that he'd found himself in. So rather than do that and kind of confront the reality, he found himself kind of caught in a vacuum where he just created a world that would fall into his worldview, which mean that he was right and that he wouldn't have to face any harsh realities. So yeah, I guess that's kind of maybe a long-winded way of looking at the difference between plot and theme.
That is so fascinating to me, to be able to talk about things and dive deeper, because, you know, you can read a comic in like, you know, an hour maybe, but not really if you're wanting to dive deeper into understanding like what's actually being talked about and the different themes and like appreciate the artwork. And so one, I wanted to say thank you for the kind of putting my question together a little bit there, pulling something out of that question. And actually, I didn't notice in There Will Be Blood the reason as to why he adopted his son, but I'm going to have to go back and, you know, look at that again, because that's really interesting. I noticed, like, there was this thing with the preacher and him, and, like, I felt like they were the same, but they had different it. And then also with what you were talking about with Frank at Home on the Farm, was there, like, when I have to read that one still, or, like, the different books on that one, so I'm going to have to get those. But with Weird Work, I saw in Weird Work that there was, like, corrupt politician and, like, things that were kind of in the background as well, like, all aliens matter and stuff like that. And that was one of my questions, was, like, with that, when I read that, it made me think about Alan Moore and how Alan Moore kind of, with V for Vendetta, had this thing where it's like ideas are bulletproof. And so you can put ideas out there with your work. And maybe that's a better way of kind of doing it rather than just like screaming out into social media and then like reaching nobody or whatever. So how do you think about that? Or like, how important do you think that is? And yeah, just in storytelling in general, maybe like putting ideas out there into the world through that medium.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think a lot, when you look at a lot of the comics and novels and anything really that have stood the test of time, it's often because there is a lot more going on under the surface than just what the kind of the synopsis of the film would be. Obviously, Alan Moore's kind of a genius in terms of his way of delivering that through comics. I guess it's a funny thing where there's a lot of talk online at the moment about old comic, you know, a certain group of people feeling that comics are too political. And, you know, we just want our characters to go out and, you know, do heroic things and for it to be like how we remember it when we were younger. But comics have always been incredibly political. I mean, there was early Captain America with him punching Hitler on the front cover, and most people are kind of not on Hitler's side. So maybe you see that and it doesn't feel like a controversial statement in the same way that the Captain Marvel cover with the "let me tell you about my strong feminist agenda," or if I might be mixing the words there, but it's, maybe that's something that for certain people that's more controversial. So it feels political to them in a way that punching Nazis doesn't feel political, but it was very political at the time. As you know, the world at that point wasn't necessarily completely aware of what the Nazis were doing. And you, I mean, you've got great runs like the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Denny O'Neill run, and how every issue was dealing with a different political situation. And even, you know, Spider-Man would swing by some anti-Vietnam protesters. And I think, I don't know if this is a slightly exaggerated story, but there's a story that Steve Ditko wanted the dialogue to be, "Oh, look at those lousy protesters. They should go and get a job." And Stan Lee wrote, oh, look at those strong Americans protesting for what they believe in. So that's one comic panel that with different dialogue can have a very different message. I think it's definitely an important thing to raise the kind of, to give people things to think about, really. Like, there's an awful lot going on in the world at all times, but right now it feels especially like we're in one of those dips in terms of people's kind of thoughts and behavior. And so kind of things that make you, I guess, like, see other people's stories from a new perspective, think outside yourself, look at how suffering of others who you maybe don't empathize with in your day-to-day life, but when you get a story that can kind of open your eyes to what other people are experiencing, I think that's a really powerful thing and something that comics can do really well, because it has a kind of the best of both worlds in terms of cinema and fiction and prose, in that you've got the images, but then you've got the ability to have the thought balloons and the captions to take you inside characters' heads, as well as like the general kind of storytelling of comics. So yeah, I think comics is reading Mouse last night, you can't get a much more powerful story than reading Mouse. And when you see that's going on banned lists, when there's a big rise in a popularity in fascism, you know, there's someone, a 14-year-old reading Mouse and empathizing with the struggle of these people, I think is, yeah, a very important thing.
I have a lot of, maybe personally I should do more research, but I think, I'm going to have to read that book because I know it was getting banned. But I think sometimes that comes in forms that can also seem socially acceptable to people until it's too late, obviously, and we've seen that. And so lately I've been trying to just be more aware and have conversations with people about it, even bring things up even when I know it might be like difficult, especially here in Canada. One of the things that I really don't like that happened was we had this bill passed, and I signed for the bill to not be passed, but it was passed, and basically our news is limited now, so we can't share news on social media, and a lot of the news we just can't see, it's blocked. And I thought that was so strange because Canada, you know, you grow up here and you think it's gonna be, I guess, I don't know. I mean, the history of Canada is bad, but just that doesn't feel right, like free speech is being limited, but there's all these excuses as to why it should be limited. Mm-hmm. And I just think that we're not actually paying attention. So yeah, not to get into that, but I just do think like, if we pay more attention, hopefully have conversations, then there might be changes.
Yeah, I mean, a big problem with social media is that people tend to sit on one side or the other and shout and scream as opposed to kind of discuss anything, which I think is a problem. It would have been interesting, I don't know, to see kind of what the reaction would have been to some of these comics when they were originally coming out. I don't know if there was social media around when Kirby drew Captain America punching Hitler, if there'd have been a bunch of people saying, oh, you know, you can't disrespect a national leader in that way on a comic or something. So yeah, I guess just on both sides, to be honest, like, you find that people are very in an echo chamber wanting what they believe to be just sent back to them, basically. And so I think everything's gone very extreme from both points of view at this point.
Yeah. Let's like have to maybe take a bird's eye view and like see, but so I had a few other questions that I just wanted to make sure that I asked before this was over. We kind of talked about the storytelling. And then the characters, like, how do you develop characters? What's the process for that, do you think? And how do they come to life for you?
So characters is an interesting one in that I don't really, it's not like I don't sit down and kind of build a character in terms of thinking about, like, oh, what do they like? What don't they like? I tend to find that the characters kind of form gradually in my head over time. And then I just kind of know their history and what's happened to them. And I'll often figure things out about a character as I'm working, but not in a way of that I've made it up, in a way that it's like, oh, okay, this is right. Like, I mean, I guess someone like Frank in Frank Home on the Farm, I had the idea for the story, and that required a certain type of character, but then as it developed, his personality kind of took form. And when it's going really well, the writing, you tend to find, and this sounds very kind of arty and a bit like, you know, a bit kind of spiritual or something, but once you really get a grip on the character, they tend to make their own decisions. So it's more like you're then kind of telling their story as opposed to making it up, in that it will just be that they'll only, in the same way that if you were confronted with a big decision in your life, there's the one way you would go and the one way you wouldn't go. And the characters kind of become like that, where you just know you can't force them to do things that they don't want to do, because I think then that becomes something that reads very false to the audience. If you've created this character with these values that they've shown through the rest of the story, and then you try for plot purposes, this is kind of something that if I do read it in any kind of fiction, that will tend to lose me as a reader, is if you can tell that the writer is trying to push the character in the direction they want the story to go, instead of the direction that the character would behave in if they were a real person. I think sometimes when people complain about the superheroes not being written correctly, I think that is the thing maybe that they're hitting on, is that the characters that they know so well from reading hundreds and hundreds of issues are doing something that doesn't fit with what they've done in the past. And often in like bad films, you know, like bad action films, bad kind of third or fourth parts of theories, it's often that characters will do really stupid stuff. You know, like you watch a horror film and someone just does something so stupid, you're like, no one would do that. That's insane. And then you kind of lose the believability of the film. Then I think that's what's happening. Like the writer, the director are like, well, you know, we've got this plan for this really cool set piece in the next section, and they need to make this bad decision to get there. And I think that's where you can sometimes lose an audience, if you're not writing in the correct nature of the character you've created.
That is so fascinating to me. I actually love that part. That's like my favorite thing to kind of think about. And Tom Waits had this quote where he said that writing is kind of like conjuring.
Mm-hmm.
Because something just like comes to you, and then you like, you're putting it on the page and you're like developing it, and at some point it is you, but it's not you. And I'm really into like the whole writing as magic thing, because I have no idea where anything really comes from, but so that is fascinating to me. And that's one of the things that I wanted to ask too, was and maybe you covered it, but like when I see good stories, they often do have that conflict where it's like, this person is a villain, but they don't maybe necessarily, they might be doing something that goes against like larger society, but they don't feel like, you're conflicted internally because they might not necessarily really be a villain. Like their motives are seem slightly virtuous, but the way that they're doing something is not. You know what I mean? I don't know if I'm
like Ra's al Ghul in Batman, who's always trying to save the planet, but his way of saving the planet is by killing all the people.
Okay, that's terrible.
Wait, so you can get behind his idea that, you know, he's like a very extreme version of a green political party, and that he's like, humans are doing so much damage to the environment and to wildlife, and I don't like this, which I think most people, unless you maybe like work for a big oil company and make lots of money that way, then I think most people can agree with that, you know, global warming is bad, like climate change is bad, killing of thoughts in like extinction of animals is bad. But then Ra's al Ghul's solution is the problem is people. So I'm going to wipe out the people. I think that's like, yeah, it's the extreme version because it's superhero comics. But yeah, I think creating that kind of that juxtaposition of, I guess another example like Thanos was similar to that in the Marvel films where he wanted to kind of make people's lives better, but the way to do that was to get rid of 50% of the people. And that definitely, it could be fun to have a really just evil villain. Like, I think there is a place for just, you know, a Darth Vader. Obviously, Darth Vader ultimately was a conflicted villain. But for the first couple of films, you know, he's just awful and scary. And that's great as well. But yeah, I think when you're, especially when you're looking to maybe make a story with deeper themes, having a conflicted villain who you can kind of understand why they're behaving like they are, but you can't actually go along with their actions. It's very interesting. And I mean, in a lot of my favorite comic stories, I don't know if you know Scout by Jason Aaron and Aaron Guerra that was released by Vertigo back in the 2000s. So that's got an amazing villain called Red Crow, who is a Native American who kind of just wants to do good things for the Native Americans, but he's so twisted and damaged inside that he can't help but hurt everyone that he knows. Yeah, and I think that definitely that kind of conflicted internal life is really important for kind of for all characters, to be honest. Even if you've got a hero, but they've got a weakness, and a lot of the dramatic tension comes from, are they going to give in to this weakness, or are they going to be able to be the hero that they want to be, is also another really interesting way to deliver a story.
Yeah. I wrote that down. I'm going to have to get that one and read it. But yeah, I always think about too, like how interesting it is sometimes that a lot of the stories that we read, we're kind of like looking internally. Like if you see all the stories, maybe as like, this might also sound very woo-woo, so just bear with me for a minute. Like if you might look at a story and you say, how can I actually relate to, maybe I don't want to, but like to all of these characters, is there a version of them that are also like within me, or is there an archetype there to explore? Like, is there a shadow side or a persona side? And I thought that was what was interesting about, I mean, not to put it back, but to There Will Be Blood, I was like, there's this persona, there is this shadow side, there's, you know, all these different archetypes. And so, I mean, looking at stories like that, being able to, you know, see them within yourself is, I think it's kind of woo-woo, but it's also very, you know, it makes it more interesting. And you know, also, you can see how every story, no matter what you read, kind of says something about you as well. And not in like a narcissistic way. Hopefully that's in a way that people are like growing, you know what I mean, and empathizing with other people. But yeah.
No, I think definitely, I mean, everything that you write will have a piece of you in it. So whichever character, no matter how kind of evil or bad they are, there's going to be something of you that's gone into that character. And I think as a writer, you do have to kind of love all of your characters, even if you don't love them all equally. You have to be able to find a way to sympathize or care a bit about someone that you're writing, or else you'll just write a very kind of one-dimensional character. I think you hear it from actors as well, like when an actor has had to portray a really awful person, they always talk about how they have to find that thing that they can empathize with within the character to kind of deliver it. Like even if they're a serial killer, maybe they're a serial killer, but because this thing happened to them, or they're a serial killer, but if things had gone slightly differently, they could have been a good person, but they were set on this course for whatever reason. As yeah, I think just doing someone who's completely irredeemable in every way, often apart from maybe the most kind of fun, campy sci-fi Flash Gordon type story, will get boring, especially if it's over time. Like if you're writing a longer series, then just having a very one-note villain, then you end up with quite a cartoonish kind of, is it Dr. Claw in Inspector Gadget? Something like that. Like like where, you know, there's not too much personality to them.
And I had my last question here, I guess. Amir, I just wanted to make sure that I had everything. Was where do you think the future of comics are? I guess you can't really say for sure, but like I am talking later today to Eben, and Eben started Macroverse, which is kind of like a digital comics. He takes comics and whole universes, but like it's all digital, so you can make digital comics, and then you have like characters that come to life digitally and stuff like that. And personally, I really do like having like a book, but I am open to like what's happening digitally. So I wanted to know maybe your take, or if you've thought about this, like where do you think comics might be in the future? What are you excited about?
Well, that's a very big question to end on, and it's kind of the question that every writer and artist and editor and publisher is thinking about. I mean, comics has been said to be dying for kind of as long as it's been around. I think ever since there were people back in the 50s saying, oh, you know, comics are dying, this is not selling anymore, such and such. But I think comics will always find a way to exist. I guess digital maybe hasn't had the take up that they were expecting when it was first coming in, because that was another thing. You know, now there's digital comics, it's going to kill print. But in reality, you know, most of us kind of comics nerds, we do like to get our physical copies of things, even if it's buying nice collected editions of stuff we read digitally originally. But I do think that a way to maybe leverage the digital side of things is going to be important. There's companies like Distillery who are new and are trying to do things like this to kind of bring a bit of interesting collectability to digital comics. I think maybe that just kind of letting people take more chances. We've moved to a place where everything, because the market has shrunk, everyone kind of wants to try and make something that's maybe a four issue thing that Netflix might pick up or something like this. And you wouldn't get a lot of the great series that I love now, things like Why the Last Man, Fable, Sandman, these kind of really long form stories, I think would have been quite hard for those writers at that stage of their career to get off the ground. And maybe finding a way to allow creators to be more creative with less kind of handcuffs on them when they're doing it. I always feel like Marvel and DC, I don't really understand why the movie companies don't just like treat them as just the cheapest R&D department you could ever find. Like, worrying about whether the publishing sides make any money when you're making so much money from the films seems a bit counterintuitive to me, where they keep kind of pushing to make money every year, even though maybe the market's shrinking. So often the way that they choose to do that is to fire a load of people, which makes it even harder to make better comics, when really they should just kind of pump some money into the comic side as a way to keep making great stories for them to then turn into the films and the TV shows that they make. Whereas I think they're starting to run out a bit, you know, as you see the way that the Marvel films are going a bit now and the audience drop off a little bit. I think that the fact that it's been harder and harder for the editors at these companies to allow the talent to kind of make these amazing stories that a lot of the earlier films were based on, I think that might come back to bite them at some point. When if they just kind of use the budget for the food services on a day of an Avengers film and gave that to the comic side each year, they'd be able to maybe keep some of the better talent and have a little bit more freedom. Because I mean, I know a lot of really of the bigger writers and artists, and even like the big names, they're often finding that by the time issue 2 is coming out, they've been told that their series is going to be cancelled at the 6th issue. So they need to kind of start wrapping it up now. And often those books are the ones that in the past would have maybe taken a little while to pick up an audience, but would have the most interesting ideas. And in the end, they become these kind of mainstays that people keep going back to. Something like Gotham Central that I love, by Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka with Michael Lark, that probably isn't something that would get to run for 30 issues now if they were to make it. I guess like Tom King just did Gotham City Year One, and that was kind of 6 or 7 issues. And something like Gotham Central is such an amazing piece of work that I think probably still sells a lot of collected editions. And that was really only allowed to happen because they were willing to say, okay, it's not selling amazing, or as far as I know, but we think this is something special and we want to give you guys the space to tell this great story. I don't know how they do that. They need to figure that's not my job to figure out, really. But no, and comics, they're all good things. You know, everything like Kickstarter and some of the new publishers. Like, there's definitely a lot to be positive about, as well as some of the more scary negative stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day of how I don't see them anymore, but they used to be able to get comics like outside of comic book stores, like at the gas station, which maybe comic book writers didn't want their work there, but I mean that you used to be able to pick some up there, and also like at the grocery store, even they'd have like a rack of books and comics. And they don't have that anymore. And I was thinking about like how I kind of got into reading comics before was from that, from just seeing them there and then diving into deeper. But how would you actually get into it today? You'd have to obviously be online and be looking around. But I was kind of saddened by that realization that I hadn't actually seen any of those lately. And also, I think it was James Gunn, but hopefully I'm not getting his name wrong. He said that he moved into making movies because comics weren't selling. And I thought, well, like a really big person in comics saying that's kind of sad. But then I see kind of online, there's a movement from people that are like making comics and like there's really great stories coming out. And so maybe I'm very optimistic, but I do think it is growing. Like, you're saying, you know, it's, like, shrinking, but I feel like it's growing some way.
I think the sales of the big two, like, a lot of the Marvel and DC sales aren't quite what they would have been 10, 15 years ago. But no, definitely on the indie side, I think with the new technologies and things, there's, like, and you're seeing the growth in things like webcomics, where some of these webcomics that then, like, Heartstopper or something like that, that become these huge successes. So I think, you know, comics is kind of like water kind of running down a mountain where if it gets blocked off in one direction, it'll find another way to kind of keep going.
Yeah. I think that was kind of like all the questions that I had, because I don't want to like continue to just take up all your time. But I really do appreciate this conversation. And I apologize, I was a bit nervous and asking all my questions, but and it was really great, and I know that people are gonna love it, and I'm really excited too, because I know a lot of the people that listen to the podcast are also interested in comics, and a lot of the people that I have on my social are comic book people, so I'm really excited for this one to go out. And yeah, the last one, you also had mentioned in one other one that you are doing some signings, so maybe you might want to mention that.
Okay.
I'll edit.
It's been really great to speak to you, Carly, and all your questions have been very thoughtful and interesting, so don't worry about it. So if people want to follow me on Twitter at Jordan_J_Thomas or on Instagram at ampersand1988, you can find kind of what I'm up to. I think I'm going to be at C2E2 in Chicago this year and hopefully try and get back over for New York Comic Con. So that will be cool. And then, yeah, so currently I have mine and Shaky Kane's Weird Work is just about to be released on February 7th from Image Comics in the trade paperback collected edition. Which is the whole like 100-page story, plus all the great covers we have by people like Jeff Darrow and Michael Red and Javier Rodriguez. And then also mine and Shaky Kane's Man for Me is coming out from Oni in the collected edition in May, I think. And then I've got a bunch of other stuff that's kind of signed up, not announced yet, but should be should be pretty cool coming in the new year. So hopefully if people like the stuff I've released before, then they'll check those out.